Can't you see it? A glistening 100-megawatt solar field begging to be built? It's photovoltaic modules and balance of system powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean? We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
When it comes to hiring, don't search for a great talent, match with them. Thanks to Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find qualified candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility. Go to Indeed.com/listen and tell them you heard about them from this podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time, turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
Play ball!
It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. I hope you're all staying safe and staying sane during this time of physical isolation for many of us. And with a lack of sports to take our mind away from the real world, it's been a challenge for those of us who work in sports media to come up with some content to keep you entertained and give you some of that sports fix you're looking for. For me, the first step was pretty easy. Sports movies. I watched Miracle twice in 3 days after spring training was canceled. That, if you don't remember, is the 2004 movie about the 1980 U.S. Olympics. Hockey team, the Miracle on Ice. Do you believe in miracles? Yes. The real story is fun to watch, and so is the Hollywood version with Kurt Russell as the late Herb Brooks. The emotions of that film are tremendous. Miracle falls into the great pantheon of sports movies that bring out emotion, just like the sporting events they're about, real or fictitious. But there's something about the real-life events that make for great films, ones that you can watch over and over again. Well, like many of you probably are, I'm a subscriber to a number of streaming services, including Disney Plus, and that's where I watched Miracle, and the other sports movies on there include The Rookie, Million Dollar Arm, Invincible, and Secretariat. And one thing that all those movies have in common is the producer who got them made, and his name is Mark Chardy. I first connected and spoke with Mark about a year ago as research for an interview I was conducting with Jim Morris, the real-life left-handed pitcher turned teacher turned pitcher again, whose life story was depicted in The Rookie, the 2002 movie starring Dennis Quaid. That was the first sports movie that Chardy turned out, and he followed up with all those others that I mentioned, making him a specialist in the type of movie that sports fans love to watch. They are about sports, sure, but they're also about the journey and the drive and determination to get through that journey, about the people behind the people who make that journey possible, about the real-life obstacles and emotions that make the stories passionate and entertaining. Mark Chardy has spent the last 2 decades making those stories in Hollywood, and one reason he connects to sports projects the way he does and is so good at bringing them to the screen is that he knows a little something about the journey. Mark Chardy is a former major league pitcher. He's from Piscataway, New Jersey, played college ball at the University of Maryland, and was drafted by the Milwaukee Brewers in 1983. He reached the majors in 87 and pitched in 4 games for the Brewers in April of that year, where he was part of Milwaukee's record streak of 13 straight wins to start the season. Mark and I discuss his own journey to the majors and experience there, but mostly this episode is about sports movies and making the kind of movies that resonate with audiences for years after they're made. At a time when rewatching old games or sports movies are the only outlets for sports fans, It's a great time to rediscover some of the movies that we love as sports fans. And I began my conversation with Mark Chardy by asking him what it is that he likes so much about sports movies and what were some of his favorites growing up.
Yeah, good question. I mean, I loved Rocky. I mean, that was, that was for me, you know, kind of life-changing in a way, like so many people. It just was this great underdog story and you know, the mood it put people in. It was you know, it moved people. I think probably before that, Brian's song was most memorable when I was even younger. I think everybody was crying in that one as well. And listen, if you can be moved by stories, then that's a great thing.
Yeah, it's more about, it's not necessarily the winning or losing in those movies that you're talking about. It was really just the connection it made with people. And I think both of those in different ways make people cry at different points, right? They're wholly emotional.
They like to sometimes be called as chick flicks for guys.
Yeah. The funny thing about most sports movies is, Mark, there's rarely a surprise ending. I mean, you almost always know how it's going to end. So why do you think we love them so much?
You know, I think it's about the journey. I think with any story, whether it's, you know, about a sports hero or a sports underdog story or not, it's about the journey. You might know the ending. Some of the more famous stories I've done, whether it's the U.S. Olympic hockey, you know, story Miracle on Ice or Secretariat, you know how those end. And, you know, I think the audience also wonders, like, well, listen, if I know how it ends, why do I want to see it? And I think you got to give them a compelling reason to, and bring them on a journey that you didn't know and tell them something that you didn't know.
Yeah, that's really the challenge, I think, with those two specifically, right? Because you're talking about some very well-known events. There are other sports movies that maybe pick something a little more obscure. Hoosiers was fictional, but based on a small-town Indiana story from 1954. Yeah. You know, Miracle on Ice, you know, all you have to do is say those words, and almost everybody who knows the sport or the sporting world knows what you're talking about. There's a special kind of challenge to making that something that people want to A, watch, and B, watch over and over again.
Yeah, I just showed my kids Miracle, and they had seen it when they were younger, and now with this virus, it's I think a lot of people are checking out, you know, films that will evoke something, make them feel good, and my kids didn't remember hardly any of it, and they loved it, and asked me a lot of questions. In fact, at one point, my son turned over and he said, "Are they going to win?" Young kids don't know the result of that story. They've maybe heard it, but that's what's great. Generations can watch these things and enjoy them. And you know, in that case, it was very steeped in history and politics. So, you know, you can learn a little something as well.
Yeah, thanks for putting my hometown in the front of that, in the opening montage. I'm from Middletown, Pennsylvania, home of Three Mile Island. So I always point to that little fire truck.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's all good. One of the reasons that I wanted to reach out to you is that, I mean, you mentioned the situation we're in and what we're all doing. I just flipped on Disney Plus, and a handful of your movies are all right there. It started with The Rookie for you. There was a baseball connection for you personally. That movie came out in 2002, but way back in 1983, after you were drafted from the University of Maryland, you're in rookie ball in Paintsville, Kentucky, and one of your teammates there is Jim Morris. Take me from there to how you made that your first big blockbuster movie.
Yeah, it's funny. Back in 83, when we signed the same year, I remember vividly pulling into Paintsville, Kentucky. Where we played was at a high school there. It was a tiny little high school in a dry county, Hazard County. And you're like, oh, my God, where are we? And I remember pulling in next to this brand new white Bronco that Jim Morris owned. And I realized that he was a first round pick. You know, secondary, whatever round, you know, however that the draft is. But yeah. I remember him being kind of one of those bonus babies with Dan Plesac. And I'm like, oh, man, they gave me $2,500 and, you know, gas money to get there. And these guys, you know, I'm behind these guys. And I remember going with Jim and a couple guys and Jim's dad to a little diner after the first practice. So it's like, you know, you kind of have these memories, and Jim and I played for 2.5 years together in the same system or same team. And then actually that rookie year, I got a real break because Jim was hurt for a start, maybe about 3 weeks into the season, and I got a spot start in Bristol, Tennessee. I threw a shutout, and from that point on, I was never out of the starting rotation for the rest of my career. So I like to commend Jim on that. He had some shoulder issues and some stuff he was dealing with throughout our time playing together, and then we actually went on different tracks. But he was a friend. I think we roomed together one spring training, and you're brothers with these guys for the whole year. You know, seven months, you're around these guys every day. You got 25 brothers, and when you play multiple seasons, you get to know people really well. But then, like a lot of things, you finish with ball, and he finished with ball, and you go on to your lives, and you don't really stay connected as much as you'd like. And man, it was 11 years, and I'm reading Sports Illustrated, this little article in the back, and they're talking about this high school teacher, 35 years old, and I'm reading this, and I can't believe it. And by the end of the article, I was like, who is this guy? And I must have glanced over the name, and then I looked again, because it said, he signed in 1983 with the Brewers, and I'm like, that's when I signed. and I couldn't believe that, this same guy that I knew all those years is now, in AAA, knocking on the door of a big league team, and he was a teacher. So I just, at that point, I was just starting my film career. I was in a garage at that point, trying to, figure it out and teach myself the business, and got really lucky. Met with, connected with the team, and then got his new agent. And then, we had set a meeting, and I met Jim up at Disney, and they ended up, making a really aggressive offer, even though it became very competitive because the whole world found out once he got called up. And, and then they came and played the Angels in Anaheim, and Bill Plaske wrote an article that the whole town then, went crazy on. And so every, for years afterwards, people would go, oh, I tried to get that project. And, we got really lucky, being in a garage and able to set it up at Disney. But that really launched my career in feature films. And that led to an overall deal with Disney and many films with them.
Yeah. Let me backtrack for a second, Mark. How did you go from the end of your baseball career? And I'll talk to you about your career, but how'd you go from finishing playing ball to getting into the movie business? And sure. Was it just kind of dumb luck of reading that SI article that you started down the road of sports movies?
Yeah, pretty much. I had, when I played, I got an agent named Dennis Gilbert, and was based in Beverly Hills. And I remember when I got put on the big league roster, he had pretty much all of the really big young Brewers, prospects. He was representing all these guys. And I remember I got called up from single A to double A in El Paso in 1985. He had all the big guys on the team, and he asked, I think I had pitched and thrown well, and he came over to me and said, hey, are you represented? And I said, no. And then he's like, well, why don't I rep you? So it was the first time I had an agent. And then later, after I got put on the big league roster, he said, hey, where are you training in the off season? I said, well, back home in New Jersey at my high school. And he started laughing. He's like, hey, why don't you come out to California? And, a lot of my guys, work out at UCLA. And, I compared, New Jersey to UCLA and Southern California. So I went out and visited, and then drove out by myself at the end of 85, right after Thanksgiving. And then that became my off-season home over the years. And a lot of my friends were out here. And I always had hoped to one day, live out here full time. But when I ended my baseball career, I ended up kind of going back east for a bit and, did some other things. And when the opportunity came to come back out here, I said, I had a lot of friends that ended up being in the film business through the 90s when I wasn't even here. And then I was like, if they can do it, let me give it a try. So I just really wanted to move back to California and Los Angeles and had no experience in the film industry. And I did know people in the film industry, which is a huge help. But I was 35 years old, knew nothing about that profession, and decided to become a producer. I guess looking back, it seems crazy, but it worked out. And you try to work really hard and figure out if you're good at something, and just really hustled and tried to find great stories like the Jim Morris story.
And you said it was a little bit of luck of just reading that SI article, but does your background as a professional athlete kind of shape the kind of stories you're looking for, and knowing, you know, just the trials of it, the drama involved in it?
I think it did. I think getting the little things right. You know, I wanted a film. You know, I saw films, sports films over the years that didn't work, right? Because it just didn't feel authentic. And with, you know, people watching so much sports, you know, on a daily basis, you can't get that wrong, right? What's hard about sports films is that you have to get the sport right, and then you have to get the dramatic and emotional parts of the story as well. So there's almost two sides to them. And, you know, you look at in trying to find great stories. I didn't set out to get you know, sports films. It was The Rookie that was the first one, and then that led to everything after that. But, I just try to find great stories, and, you know, I love underdog stories. I think, you know, America loves a good underdog story, and that's really the essence of all of the stories that I've done. They're all great underdog stories and redemptive stories.
And I guess Miracle was the second one you made after The Rookie, correct?
Yeah.
So how did you come upon, obviously you went from a story that hardly anybody knew, you know, despite the little publicity that you're talking about surrounding Jimmy Morris, to a story that everybody knew. How did you go about choosing that, making that, and you know, what were the challenges for you of getting that done the right way?
Yeah, I think everything is about timing. And, you know, at the point when that story came to us, it was a little over 20 years after the story had happened. And I think right after the event, there was a TV movie and very forgettable. And so when a writer came in to pitch the story, it just felt like the right time in a weird way. And that, you know, this story needed to be told. There's a generation of people that didn't really know it, of younger kids. And, you know, looking back on a story that meant so much when it happened and now has a little space in between it, I think that gave a little more relevance to the story. And, you know, I think there was also an HBO documentary that this writer watched and felt like, man, this could be a great movie. And, came in, pitched us, and you know, we ended up going out to the town, and Disney put their hand up for that one as well, and that really cemented, you know, our relationship. And then we ended up with an overall deal at Disney for 12 years, and now I'm back doing movies with them as well. So, you know, kind of came full circle.
You know, Miracle is a good example of this. I want to get your thoughts on, you know, the idea of the based on a true story. You always have to take some creative liberties in making a movie like that. But you're a sports guy, and you mentioned, you know, what you value in that. So does the athlete in you ever wrestle with the movie producer in you as you're trying to make a story like that is well known?
Well, there's a motto that we follow. It's don't let the facts get in the way of the truth. Right. So I think the first thing you have to do is you have to entertain an audience. And sometimes in films, you will play with timelines, you will fictionalize or make composite characters. And, you know, you've got to create scenes, right? There wasn't a microphone in every, you know, different, you know, conversation that's had in a movie, right? You have to create, you got to find out what the truth was. You have to interview people that are around it, and you got to get the essence of what happened and authentic. So I think it's a skill to have a writer be able to do that in a great way. And, you know, Mike Rich, who wrote four of those movies for me, was a guy who took great care in crafting a story and finding those emotional through lines and moments, those movie moments, you know, that you want to set up and pay off. And, whether it's Kurt Russell's speech and Miracle, or, you know, with Jim Morris and some of the things that Dennis Quaid did so well, you know, you got to build that emotion through the story. So when you have that triumph, there's real emotion there, and it's not just, you know, an accomplishment on the field. It's got to resonate emotionally with the characters that you set up.
Because you're so closely attached to these, and you know all the ins and outs of them, are you relying on your emotion telling you that it's right, or are you kind of watching those around you?
Well, that's what a little bit of the skill you have to get, you know, as a producer. You know, you have to know when scripts work, right? I mean, I don't write, I can't write, but I know when writing is working well, and I know how to give notes, and I think I have a sense for storytelling that any good producer would do, and you've got to be able to convey those notes and keep making a script better. There's times when scripts go backwards, right? And those movies don't end up getting made.
Right.
And there's times when you have to change writers, and then you have to figure out. So there's a craft to developing a movie and getting it in the best shape you can. Sometimes it's a relay race where you're handing off to someone else, and then you bring a director in, and then there's another layer of development because it's got to be the director's vision. So there's a whole host of things, and that's why development takes years sometimes to get scripts just right. And you never really finish developing scripts. You're always writing and polishing right up to the day you shoot, and sometimes on that day.
I watched Miracle on my flight home from Florida to New York as basically spring training was canceled. And then I watched it again 2 days later. And it's just one of those movies that, as Bill Simmons would say, is a rewatchable. We all just love to watch them all over again. And this time, this is what we're doing without sports. We're reaching back to these movies. Maybe it's not yours, but what's one that you like to go back and watch over and over again that maybe brings out certain emotions in you?
Yeah. I think those first two movies, The Rookie and Miracle,
yeah.
They all have, they're kind of like all your kids, but there's certain ones that resonate a lot. The Rookie just was like a magical, it was my first movie. It was something that, you get thrown into a situation, work from starting in a garage, then all of a sudden you're producing a movie and you're on a set with some kind of, it's a little bit daunting, but also a little bit magical when you see how many people it takes and the teamwork. And, you work on the words for so long, and then all of a sudden, like I always like to say that the movie making is the easy part, right? That's, you're making it, enjoy it, make it the best you can. It's so hard to get movies made, right? They're multi-million-dollar investments.
Yeah.
And you're competing with thousands and thousands of other projects. So to get a movie made is an accomplishment. And then, when you're making it, you just got to kind of ride that thing and make sure that, what you have on the page is being executed, on the day when you're shooting, and make sure you get the little things right. And, sometimes there's bigger decisions and things you have to kind of roll with, and then the movie ends, and then you're done in 3 months, and then, a six month editing process happens, and then you're shaping the film even more. So it's kind of a great project or a process where a lot of it is getting that script to where it needs to be, and because if it's not going to be good, it's not going to be good on screen.
Secretariat is one that I haven't seen, but it's going to be on my list now. What was it about that story and what people don't know that made you want to go back and make that one?
Yeah, again, that was something that Mike Rich wrote and had always had a love for horse racing and this horse in particular. Now, the idea that Secretariat was an underdog, it's not the case. It was considered the greatest racehorse ever.
Yeah.
But what the underdog element was, that was Penny Chenery, who, inherited this farm and had to figure out, could she keep it? Could she afford to keep it? Back in the 70s, you had inheritance taxes of 70%. So she literally had to bet the farm on this horse.
Wow.
They basically had sold the breeding rights ahead of time and basically had to predict that the horse had to win the Triple Crown, right? Anything short, and they could not keep the farm. They couldn't, do what they were doing. And so a woman in a very, male oriented business is, so it's really her story and how she navigated that and how she had to step up and face all these, all the adversity that goes along with that. And then as the horse, had a couple failures leading up to the Triple Crown, and then all of a sudden, it just goes on this unbelievable streak. But each race led to more pressure on the next race and then the next race. So the idea of kind of creating that adversity within these races and what that horse had to overcome at the same time what she had to overcome personally was when the pressures made a really great film. I'd like to know your opinion of it when you watch it, because that was another film that was, received really well and obviously had women really gravitated toward that as well, because we had a lead with, Diane. And I love that film as well. That was, again, for me as a kid watching that race and then being at the Kentucky Derby and meeting Penny Chenery and being down there and inside that action, both that story and Miracle on Ice were like things I watched and revered as a young kid, and then all of a sudden I'm making these stories was, you know, for me, amazing, right? Those are some of the great things about, you know, being able to tell stories and bring those people back together to tell them.
I'm going to grab a box of tissues and I'll give you my review as soon as I finish with that one. Tell me about Invincible. I know that's a story that people around Philadelphia kind of knew about Vince Papale. But again, you're talking about some real characters that are somewhat well known and telling the broader story that maybe isn't quite as well known.
Yeah, in some ways, it was like The Rookie in that, you know, you had a guy way past his prime that, you know, is trying to make a team in his mid-30s. And in this case, there was about maybe 20 years or so between, or even longer, I think it happened in 76, the 25 years, the 30 years before when that story happened and when we actually made the movie. So, again, people forget about these stories, and sometimes having that distance between when that happened and when you make the story adds to it. It's a story a lot of people don't remember unless you're from Philadelphia, but he was a bartender. And when Dick Vermeil came to coach the Eagles, he wanted to shake things up. He had this open tryout just to, you know, again, shake things up. And here's this bartender who played rough touch football and, loved the Eagles so much. And he was a great athlete, but you know, great athlete is one thing, when you're playing rough touch football, another is trying to make a team, and he ended up making it. I didn't know at all about the story. And they had done, NFL Films had done a little bumper piece leading into Monday Night Football. It was like a 5-minute little intro talking about on the 25th anniversary of Rocky and then this real life Rocky in Philly, you know, for the Eagles. And it just kind of blew up Hollywood and everyone tried to get the rights to this. And they came back around to me. It was developed. A script was developed. And we ended up getting it for Disney and then redeveloping it some more. And that was just a fun film. I became very close with Vince and his family. And again, you know, I think for people that, you know, especially when you don't think a movie's going to be made and then all of a sudden, you know, years later they do get made. That's a really fun part of what I do is, you know, watching the principals watch this thing unfold and being able to relive it and then seeing it on the screen. It's really emotional. That's probably the most fun that I have is showing the movie to in a crowd to the people that the movie's about, and they almost always react very emotionally, and you know, that's the best feeling.
The other baseball movie that you made is Million Dollar Arm, and that one I watch very closely because, you know, one, I'm the son of Indian immigrants, and I remember when these two kids were signed and the idea of, you know, how far major league teams are willing to go to look for talent, but the story of them getting here and just getting out of where they were is the essence of your story, not the fact that they had any sort of success over here. It was the success of just that part of the journey.
Yeah. You know, again, it's a lot like The Rookie and Invincible in that, you know, you don't have to become an all-star or a Hall of Famer, right? Yeah. It's just getting there, right? With Rocky, it was just, he went the distance, you know? So it's all about that journey. And this was a pretty amazing story because I was friends with J.B. Bernstein and I remember when he told me he was going over to India to find a baseball player. I was laughing at him. It was at a Super Bowl party in Phoenix back whenever, I think it was the Giants Patriots. And I was like, I could barely hear him. And he was telling me this in a crowd. And I just remember looking at him like, are you crazy? And probably 8 months later, he's in my office. He's like, man, I got these guys and I'm getting them signed. And it was like this crazy, crazy thing that, it was like an experiment, right? You go over to the middle of India and find these two kids who have a good arm and try to teach them how to pitch. And, you know, with the idea that you could open up India as a market, which I do think will happen someday. Cricket is king over there, but, you know, that motion, everyone throws there, everybody in the streets, you know, you go there and kids are throwing stuff. So you got to feel, you know, the idea that you could find someone with a great arm. And that's what they did. And, you know, these kids got signed by Pittsburgh. And, you know, again, it's just them getting signed was the amazing thing. And that's the end of the story. I love making that film. I love being in India and experiencing that culture and became really close with John Hamm. during that process. It was just a fun movie. Listen, anytime you can make a baseball movie, for me, it's so that's why I think The Rookie and this one were kind of near and dear to me, because, you know, you get to go back on a baseball field, which is always great.
All right, so let's talk about your baseball career. I mentioned earlier you were drafted out of Maryland in 83. You came up to the big leagues in 87, and you only made four appearances, but you made four appearances with the Brewers in April of 1987, one of the greatest months that any team has had in Major League history. They started out 13-0. What do you remember about being part of that run? I'm going to spoil this for other people a little bit. They started 17-2, and those two losses were games both started by you.
That's correct. But I came out with the lead in the second one. So,
yes, you did.
Not my fault. But,
what do you remember about the run?
I remember it, you know, listen, anytime it happened so fast, right? Because, you know, I ended up making the big league team, and I was a starting pitcher. I was the fifth starter. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, your boyhood and childhood dream comes true. And I remember my first game, I was supposed to pitch the fifth game in Texas. And during the third game, we opened up against the Red Sox after they had had that memorable series with the Mets with Mookie Wilson and Buckner. Yep. You know, I'm facing all the same. It's the same team that you just watched from home. You know, 5 months later, 4 months later, here I am. I'm in long relief, and our starting pitcher Mike Birkbeck was getting hit around, and they said, like, if he gets, if you go in, it'll be in the first inning or two. And then we'll reshuffle our rotation. So I figure the chances of getting in are like 2%. So I'm sitting out in the center field, you know, kind of bullpen, and I'm hanging out. And all of a sudden, they start scoring runs. In second inning, they're like, "Charlie, get up!" And I'm like, I don't even have my spikes on, so I'm running around. I didn't have time to think about it, but all of a sudden, then 10 pitches later, they're asking, "Are you ready?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And the gates open, and I'm running in from center field, and I've got to face Jim Wrights and Dwight Evans with the guy in second and third and one out. So I was just like, oh, my God. And ended up getting out of that inning without giving up any runs and pitched a 1-2-3 next inning. And I'm like, oh, this is easy. And then I think the third inning, I hung a changeup to Dave Henderson, and he hit a home run. The catcher comes out, and he's like, "Rook, what are you?" And he starts yelling at me, you know, why are you throwing a changeup off a fastball? Just throw what I put down. And I ended up throwing pretty well. I came out with the lead, and then they tied it. The inherited runner scored, but, and I don't know why I'm going to the weeds here, but
no,
I remember every pitch.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up winning that game, came from behind. Then I pitched the eighth game in Baltimore, and we beat the Orioles 5-3. At that point, we're 8-0. I think Juan Nieves had pitched the no-hitter the game before. So now there's a lot of national attention.
Yeah.
Right? We're, I think, the only undefeated team at 8-0. I can't remember who we came home and played, and we had two come-from-behind wins, and that, all of a sudden, we're 13-0. We tied a major league record.
Yeah.
And I saw that I was going to be pitching the 14th game in Chicago. I was like, oh, God, here we go. It was like a World Series atmosphere, because it was like there was cameras up and down the line. It was nonstop news programs. We were in Chicago, and that is the birth of the Cheeseheads. And I've told people that story for years, and if you look in Wikipedia, the guy who started it, it was that series in Chicago. I know Rick Manning had said something in spring training calling the fans Cheeseheads when they would get off the bus from these long rides from Wisconsin, and it just kind of stuck, and they embraced it. And then all of a sudden, this guy made a foam Cheesehead, and that started it.
Wow.
A lot of people think it's from the Packers, but it's not. It's from that series. And anyway, I lost that game, did not throw well. We won then four games after that, and then I pitched against the Angels, came out with a 5-4 lead. We ended up losing that one. And so then I was the bad luck charm for the team. But no, and then I got sent down and thought I was going to get back up. They had called me back up at one point, and I had tweaked my back. I didn't get that opportunity. And then, you know, they just didn't call anybody up at the end of the year, and which I thought they would. And then, you know, I felt like probably I wasn't in their plans, you know. And I came back the following year and started having some arm trouble, and then I just retired. So, you know, I left on my terms, and you know, glad I made it to the big leagues. But you know, those are long, tough journeys. And, you know, I also didn't want to be in the minor leagues for another 2 years. And mm-hmm. I didn't have control of my destiny, and I just figured, you know what, I'm gonna leave on my terms, and I'm gonna figure out my next chapter and my life.
Is there, you know, it's funny because your career kind of mirrors some of these things we're talking about the journey of just getting there. You don't have to be a superstar or a Hall of Famer. Have you ever thought about anything autobiographical that would make sense for a movie?
About me? No, I don't think anybody would care. But no, I think what you hit on as far as, like, I always felt like I was an underdog, right? Everything. I wasn't a high draft pick. I was undersized compared to guys now. I just, you know, it's a tough road, you know. Sometimes it's a lot easier if you're the guy that is anointed and they've got a big investment in. So for me to get up there, it was a huge, probably a bigger accomplishment than for others, you know. So I just always gravitated toward underdog stories. Going back to Rocky, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned that movie earlier. There's just something about that the journey and the success is so much sweeter when the road's harder. And so maybe that's part of why I like underdog stories and end up making those films and being drawn to them. But yeah, maybe there's some connection.
Do you watch sports differently because of your role as a movie producer? Is there always something in you that's kind of looking for a story like that? Or do you get to watch sports like the rest of us as something that you just want to watch to enjoy?
Yeah. No, I watch to enjoy, but I think, like a lot of people love these kinds of stories, right? These success stories. I don't think I'm, you know, unusual in that fact. I just happen to be in a business that, you know, I try to make these stories and turn them into films. But I think that connection that I might have, a lot of other people do as well. Everybody loves a good underdog story. So it's just trying to find them and get them and make them the best you can, and executing them is what I do.
I had a chance to speak to Angelo Pizzo recently, who wrote Hoosiers and Rudy, and he told me he's a little burned out on sports, mostly because he doesn't want to ever think about writing another locker room speech. But I, you know, you're not a writer necessarily, so is this the kind of genre that maybe you didn't necessarily think you'd fall into, but is this kind of where you think you're going to keep going?
I think there's always that little bit of, like, you fight what people put you in a box in, right? Or define you as. So obviously Angelo is known as the guy that wrote that and this, and he's the sports guy. Obviously I've done a lot of sports movies. So when the phone rings, I pretty much know it's going to be about a sports project, you know? So I've got to fight that and round out what I do. I don't want to be defined as just that, but I love making them. I keep looking for great stories. I think the bar gets higher, right? You don't want to repeat yourself. I think I know it could be a movie, but I think they all have to be somewhat unusual and different. And, you know, I just did a movie for Disney that's going to be on the platform in October about a Clemson football player named Ray McElrathbe. It's untitled right now, but we shot it in the fall at Clemson, and amazing story. What was famous about him is that he was, again, not a famous player. He was a freshman coming from Atlanta, recruit, defensive back, safety, and he ended up adopting his little brother, who's going to go into foster care, and it became an NCAA issue on, you know, can you get a ride to school? Is that an infraction? Mm. And on appeal, he ended up getting a waiver from the NCAA. So not only did the school come out and look good, so did the NCAA, which is unusual. So really emotional, terrific movie. We got to shoot in front of 85,000 people during a live game, and it was nuts. It was such a fun film to shoot, and I've seen cuts of it already. It's fantastic. So, you know, again, trying to find great stories and execute them. That's what it's about, you know, getting people to believe that the story could be relevant and can resonate, and again, that's what movies I do are about.
There's one thing on your IMDb page, an upcoming project that is not sports related at all, but it caught my eye because my favorite singer of all time is Sam Cooke, and there is an untitled Sam Cooke bio that is somewhat loosely attached to you. What can you tell me about where that's been going?
Here's what I can tell you. Don't look at IMDb. those things are sometimes 15, 20 years old and inactive projects that might have been announced at the time, but those aren't typically too accurate. But at one point I was involved in developing and had developed the Sam Cooke project. Funny thing about that is I still get calls about it from you know, actors, reps, and that story will probably get made, and you know, it's but a lot of times stories go from active to inactive and then change, you know, people involved with them. And at the time didn't get made, but I do feel like that will be made eventually. I probably won't have involvement in it, but, it's a really, you know, great, but tragic story, the Sam.
So what's your dream project, Mark? Is there something that you look at and say, boy, I can't believe that hasn't been made yet?
You know, I've got things that I really believe in and think are great, and I'm still working on. You know, there's a story that I got the rights to back in 2007. By the way, the same year as the movie I just made for Disney. Sometimes they take a year to get made. Sometimes they take 15, 20, 30 years. But about Mike Flint, he was a 59-year-old guy who when he was in a small college in West Texas, he got kicked off the football team. He was the captain. He got in one too many fights, and the school president said it's either the football team or Mike Flint. So he gets kicked off the team, doesn't even get to say goodbye, and all of a sudden he's back home. You cut to, you know, however many years later, 40 years later, and, you know, you find out that he's going to go finally back to a reunion to apologize to his teammates, and he had never been connected to him, and he did, and a lot of the guys were like, hey, listen, you look like you can still play. And they start laughing. And, you know, you got a year of eligibility. And anyway, he goes to school and says he wants to try out. And they think it's like he's going to want to coach or it's his kid. And he ends up making the team as a middle linebacker at 59. And
wow.
Tremendous story. It's called The Senior. And I'm still working on that one. I think it'll get made. A lot of start and stops with that, but it's one that I love, and I definitely think it's a movie. We got a really good script. You know, it's timing. You got to find, you know, either investors or studios or, you know, platforms that, you know, that believe in you. A lot of times it's one or two people within that. You know, you can get passes for years from different, and then find that one person that believes in the story, and, you know, I hope to make that someday for sure.
You know, the thing I keep thinking about these sports movies is that, you know, there are a few exceptions to it, but generally they're not blockbusters. They are successful, and if you're lucky, you can have them on a platform like you have with, you know, Disney Plus now offers The Rookie, Invincible, Million Dollar Arm, Miracle, Secretariat. They're all there, and there are movies that we're going to watch again, but you have to really want to make that story and have that story speak, because these aren't the typical Hollywood blockbusters that are coming out.
Yeah. No, they are. They're not, they don't scream, you know, blockbuster, but that's why I think these platforms are great places to tell these stories. You don't have to worry about box office. I think that's become really tricky over the years. And, you know, who goes to a movie theater, right? Who actually, some of them might want to see a film, but they might want to wait and not actually get in their car and drive and, you know, do all that goes along with, you know, the effort to get to a film, and with the advent of Netflix and Amazon and all this content that you can consume in your house, it becomes a kind of a great play to make these original films that feel very theatrical, much like the one I just did for Disney that'll be on their Disney Plus platform. Okay. It's the same budget. You know, mm-hmm. these are big budgeted movies, and there's absolutely no difference in the quality or price, and you know, obviously for Disney and other places, it's the future. You know, it's why Bob Iger, you know, bet so much on Disney Plus, and you know, Netflix has such a big lead on everyone else in the subscriber, you know, kind of content, you know, platform that all these other studios who've helped build Netflix into what they are now going, oh God, we got to do this ourselves, because that's how people are consuming content. So. Big transition, you know, big disruption in my business. But as a filmmaker, as a producer, you just got to find and tell great stories. You know, you'll figure out where you make them and who finances them and how people see them. But, you know, more people see them once they get onto these other, you know, downstream, whether it's seeing it on a plane or seeing it, you know, on a cable channel or a network or a platform. I mean, that's going to be the new. And, you know, for me, I want to execute and tell great stories.
Yeah, and listen, I think we're all kind of in that boat right now. As long as you have to shelter in place or self-quarantine, whatever you have to do,
hey,
these are our options.
A lot of people are watching movies now. You know?
Yep. And they're watching a lot of yours too, because they make you feel good. And I think that's what, as sports fans, that's what we're kind of looking for. We're looking for something that gives us that same energy and emotion that we don't get because there is no March Madness and no other sports right now.
Totally agree.
My thanks to Mark Chardy for sharing his thoughts on making some of the more timeless sports movies of the last 20 years. As I mentioned earlier, you can see most of his movies on the Disney Plus streaming service. And to hear more about the making of Hoosiers from screenwriter Angelo Pizzo, please check out our last episode. You can find the 30 with Murdy archive at radio.com, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. Subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, stay safe, everyone. I'm Sweeney Murdy. And thank you for listening.
Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Payoff up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Football fans, do you want to hear the whole unadulterated truth about where your team stands?
It's the most embarrassing film I have ever watched in my entire life.
Former NFL lineman Mark Schlereth gives his perspective on the top storylines and games on a weekly basis on the Stinkin' Truth Podcast.
You may get out of here with two sacks and a tackle for loss, but you're getting out with a bloody nose.
New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday.
It's going to be a street fight.
Make sure to subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.